Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
So would that indicate that the muhurtas will also adjust?
Muhurtas, according to the Purana, sort of a fixed length.
Ah, okay. So as long as
it's like... the statement from the Vishnu Purana that for the midsummer, the length of daylight hours is 18 muhurtas, and the midwinter is 12 muhurtas.
Okay.
The length of the four kinds of days... Stella days, solar days, tithis, and sunrise to sunrise. Three of them are not fixed. They vary throughout the year, and only the movement of the stars is the fixed one. So from that is determined the length of dandas and so on.
Okay. So according to nakshatras, then. So that would place the nakshatras as quite prominent.
Yes. They're the only fixed, constant movement.
Oh, okay. Okay, so even more than the sun.
The sun, he has his constant movement within a specific orbit, but the speed he takes on that varies throughout.
Right. So I'm saying that nakshatras are the only really fixed, because they're considered in the modes of nature to be in the topmost level of goodness. So Lord Brahma himself, the Mahatattva, the nakshatras, I think the Prajapatis, and Dharma Shastra, they're considered to be the top. Within the material sphere, the most situated in the highest levels of goodness. So it must be their steadiness.
Constancy.
Yeah. So verses 31 to 34. The battle is already won by Krishna, and Arjuna should only become Krishna's instrument and take the credit. Verse 31. O Lord of Lords, so fierce of form, please tell me who you are. I offer my obeisances unto you. Please be gracious to me. You are the primal Lord. I want to know about you, for I do not know what your mission is. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, Time I am, the great destroyer of the worlds, and I have come here to destroy all people. With the exception of you, the Pandavas, all the soldiers here on both sides will be slain. Therefore, get up, prepare to fight and win glory. Conquer your enemies and enjoy a flourishing kingdom. They are already put to death by my arrangement, and you, O Savyasachi, can be but an instrument in the fight. Drona, Bhishma, Jayadratha, Karna, and the other great warriors have already been destroyed by me. Therefore, kill them and do not be disturbed. Simply fight, and you will vanquish your enemies in battle. So, bewildered by fear, Arjuna prays for the Lord's grace and inquires who he is and what his mission is. Right? So, because he knows Krishna in a particular way, in a particular rasa, so in this form he doesn't know. So he's bewildered, so he's afraid, as we mentioned, because fear comes from not knowing one's position, one's relation. So, he doesn't know that relation, so he's feeling that fear. Right? So he's asking, what are you here? What is your mission? Right? Because somebody always is doing something. If you have an identity, you do something, you get a result. So what is it that you're doing? What is your purpose? Right? The Supreme Lord declares that he is time, the great destroyer of the worlds. He says that except for the Pandavas, everyone will be slain. He encourages Arjuna to fight as an instrument and kill those who are already destroyed by him. Right? So, because Krishna is coming to establish Dharma, right? And so here is, and protect the devotees. So here then, Dharma is being established. And so you're trying to get rid of all the demoniac personalities. So rather than, knock them off one by one, then you create this situation in which you can have something very wonderful, right? 5,000 years later, people are still talking about it. And that will go on for a long time, because the Gita, Nanda Baba quotes Gita, right? So when would the last time the Gita have been spoken? At Nanda Baba's time, right? At the end of the previous Dwapara Yuga. So that means 4,300,000 years previously. That's when it was last spoken. Right? Does that make sense? And it's a regular thing. And then even here, Krishna's saying he spoke to the sun god, you know, and then to Ikshvaku, and like this it came down. So like this, you're talking millions and millions of years before it's been spoken. And so, you know, these things are quite famous, right? We're still talking about Ramachandra's victory in over Ravana. And that we're talking about more, because Treta Yuga will be, you know, three segments, right? So that means you have Dwapara will be, instead of 4,300,000, it will be 8,600,000. And the Treta Yuga will be, what is it? 12 million, then what do you say? 900, right? So you're talking much longer before, right? So something like this, why? Because it's so great, it's so special, it's so unique. So the Lord, when he does things, he does them very unique because he's trying to attract the mind of the living entity, right? If you just do something ordinary, who cares, right? If you do something very big, everyone talks about it. Right. Does that make sense? Yes.
I'm wondering, everybody will be slain. So all these millions of people who are siding with the Pandavas, are they righteous but just not quite righteous enough?
That's whatever. It's just part of the scene. Because even if they are, because you have to remember that a lot of them, oh no, that's on the other side. Duryodhana got. The other side. It means there's a reason, because they're there, but then there'll be that power and all that, then the problem is they, when Krishna goes, they might misuse it also. So even those who are useful, then it may be a problem. Like I think it was Madhvacharya? Or no, I think it was Nila. What's his name? Nila. The sword of Vishnu. But his short name is Nila. He's one of the 12 Alwars. So he, you know, was building the walls around Sri Rangam. You see, the walls you see today, like right around the temple and that, these big, really thick, very high walls, those were built by him. And so he had three disciples. One could walk on water, one could open any lock, and one could hide in his own shadow. Right? So with those three, then they would go out and, fundraise. Yeah. Right? And so, as long as he was present, then they would be controlled. But when he was going to leave, he sent them first. Because otherwise, if he left and left them there, then they would make trouble. Right? So, we also have that element. Okay, yeah, no, I think seven people were left. The Pandavas, then Satyaki, and Kritavarma. And that was it. Well, Ashwatthama also made it, but he didn't make it so, you could say, gloriously. So basically, that was all. Also, no, one more. So it was nine. It was also Vikarna. Wasn't it Vikarna? No. You sure? Oh, Vikarna was killed. There was the other. There was that one son of the maid servant. It's a brother, but he's not counted in the 100. Yuyutsu. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so he was very powerful, like that. He's mentioned as one of the great Maharatis, but because he's not technically Kshatriya, pure Kshatriya blood, so he was sent back to take care of Dhritarashtra and Gandhari, like that. So these were the only ones that were left out of the whole of that. In other words, on the Pandava side, then there were so many more were left. Duryodhana's side was basically wiped out, but there were so many left on the Pandava side. But then Ashwatthama got the bright idea of at night when they're sleeping and going and killing them, and that was somehow or another pleased Duryodhana. Right? It didn't, but, you know, so this way everyone got killed except these persons. The Pandavas weren't killed because they, in tradition, when you defeat the other army, one of the options is staying in the enemy's camp. You defeated them, so you stay in their camp that night, right, rather than your own camp. So they weren't in the camp like that. And then Yuyutsa was, because the battle's over, he was sent back. So then that would be, so that's five, that's six, right? And then you had Kripa, Ashwatthama, and what was it? Satyaki. So then, not Satyaki. Yeah, no, Kritavarma. Kritavarma is Satyaki. No, but they were in the other camp. They must have stayed with the Pandavas. So then, but Ashwatthama, Kripa, and there was one more. Yeah, they made the plan to kill everybody. Like that. So then they went through the camp. So that's it. All the other 640 million are more, they say. They became historical before these Pandavas became, you know, they say. So the point the universal form is saying is that he's time, he's destroying everything. Right. Well, also we saw before he creates everything, he maintains everything, but he's saying what is his mission? So his mission in this context is to destroy all these warriors. So there are, it's already done. Now Arjuna can take part in this, right? And he calls them Savyasachin, because Savyasachin means very expert at shooting arrows. So he can shoot with either hand. Right? Does that make sense? So we even just saw the other day, an example of this, present day man, he can hold, they means, generally we think of, you have the bow and arrow, then you have your quiver, you take it, one arrow out, you pull it, you shoot it. But it's mentioned that Arjuna's bow always looked like a circle. Right? So then there's this one man, he can shoot, I think it's 10 arrows in 12 seconds, which is very fast, and that's fully pulling it and hitting the target. So what he does is he holds all the arrows in his fingers. Right? He holds them in his fingers, holds the bow, and then shoots. You know, so he shoots, then takes an arrow, shoots, and that. So there is systems for this. So Arjuna would be, you know, would have at least something as like this, if not better. Yes.
In Mahabharata, somebody mentioned that actually it wasn't possible to see the whole process of Arjuna taking the arrow from the quiver and putting it in the bow and then shooting.
Shooting? No, it was because it was so quick. That's what's meant of light of hand, lightness of hand is that. It's just so expertly they can take things and like that. So you had a few of the warriors were like this, that they were commented on that their lightness of hand. So Arjuna is one of them. I think Satyaki was also another one of them like this. They're very expert. It would say you just see the steady stream of arrows. It's like, you know, one right after another. It'd be kind of like a, you know, Los Angeles traffic jam, right? There'd be so many of them like that. So it's like, So he's referred to that he'll be the best one to do this, because otherwise they're going to be killed anyway. But if, you know, some, you know, not very important character does it, then it's kind of, they're going to think, well, it didn't, that doesn't make sense, right? So a qualified person like Arjuna is able to do this, right? And Krishna's already arranged that they're all killed. So this combination will be very good, right? So that's the point that was made before by some others to Duryodhana, is that the same scenario was there with Narayana Rishi, right? And killing the demons when they were, you know, they were attacking the demigods. So just the two of them defeated the whole host of the Asuric army. And then they point out after saying this, and they go, yes, that's true. Then they go, that same Naranarayan is Krishna and Arjuna. Right? So the point is, so how do you think you're going to defeat them? Right? Just the two of them can destroy everyone you have, let alone they have an army. Right? You know, so that was the point. And they always use bows and arrows. Like that. You know, Arjuna would always use a bow and arrow. Like that. So Narayan would use a Sudarshan. Like that. But Nara would use a bow and arrow. So between the two of them, then they didn't stand a chance. Right? So Sudarshan is time. Right? So Krishna through time has killed them all, and now Arjuna will kill them with his bow and arrow. Srila Baladeva Vidyabhushan writes in his commentary to verses 32 and 33. Krishna says, even without your fighting, they will be killed. In the form of time, I will take their lifespan. But you, if you give up the battle, will have deviated from your dharma. Therefore, rise and fight according to your dharma. Gain fame. Attain rare glory. Quote, warriors such as Bhishma, who cannot be conquered by the Devas, have been conquered by Arjuna. End quote. Such will be your fame. They have already been killed by me at the time they offended Draupadi. They are proceeding like puppets to give you fame. Therefore, just become the instrument. Right? So that's what we were discussing yesterday. Is that the reason the whole dynasty and all these kings will be killed is because of the insult to Draupadi. Right? So just the whole dynasty will be so at that time, Krishna already arranged that they'll all be killed. Because if you do something like this, your lifespan is shortened. Right? Yes.
Well, you said that was caused by the insulting and chaste woman. Is that?
Yes.
Is that described in Manu?
Yeah, Manu mentions that. Because he's going through, it's going through all the different things. Because in the Vedic culture, you always have a balance. See, that's the element that's very important to catch. We, you know, for us it's very easy if it's one way or the other. But the balance is the perfect. So that's why the actual conclusion, the ultimate conclusion, you could say, of the Vedic literature is the Chinta-Veda-Veda-Tattva. Is how you can have two contradictory elements, but they perfectly synthesize because of the commonality of origin. Right? Does that make sense? So that aspect, that's what's special in Lord Chaitanya's presentation, because we see all the other presentations are very simple. They're very straightforward, right? That means you have dwait. It's two. No discussion of any variety of oneness. It's just not even brooked. Right? Madhvacharya felt Ramanuja was an impersonalist because of his, you know, Vishishta Dwait philosophy. Right? That it's, you know, the special oneness. That he meant oneness in purpose, not oneness in form. But Madhvacharya wasn't even going to tolerate any aspect of anything being one. Right? But you're dealing with that. The oneness of it, but in mood, or Vishuddha Dwait, that purity of that endeavor and everything like that. So that Vishuddha Dwait, right? Then you have Dwait Advait, right? It's two, it's one. You can look at it both ways, but not simultaneously, right? And Advait, right? That's the simplest, right? So then, but Achinta-Veda-Tattva means you can see at the same time, simultaneously, the two contradictory things functioning at once with no contradiction. That's what our philosophy provides. These are the difficult parts because they overlap. You know, if we look at it from one way and then look at it from another way, completely, and don't refer to each other, that is very easy. But when you refer to them both at once, that's where the difficulty comes. So that's the difficult aspect that is there in understanding in the Gita. How all this can happen at once. Right? Does that make sense?
Can you give one example?
how by performing means the point of value is its connection to Krishna. So you perform a pious activity, it's its connection to Krishna that makes it valuable. The piety is simply the quality of what you're connecting. But the piety on its own doesn't actually have any value or meaning. You know, that's like saying, you know, the coconut tree and the pond in the mirage, those are of more value than, you know, just the sand that's around the pond. You know what I'm saying? It's all an illusion anyway, so it's not that one's more valuable than another. So then, therefore, then the point is then even something that's not pious could be connected to Krishna. Because its connection to Krishna is what's important. So then you have this this conflict of the pious and the impious. Because one sees them of actual value because of our understanding of karma. Or, you know, that karma is that religious activities must be good. And so that's the good quality of it. You know, the person's, you know, very regulated, very humble, very detached, and, you know, deals very nicely. That's his good quality. Not that, no, those are there in their connection to Krishna. That makes them good. Because there's plenty of people that are like that in the material world that aren't devotees. So it's actually its connection to Krishna that's valuable. Right? So we said the quality of a pious act is of better, how do you say? The mechanics of it, the overall result of it, the creating less of a disturbance is all greater in a pious act as opposed to an impious act. Right? The impious act is working on a much smaller scale. So its result and its long-term effect are much smaller. At the same time, as it can also have more of a disturbing effect. That's why it's considered impious, because it disturbs the environment, while the pious activity doesn't. Does that make sense? You know, let's say watering plants in the morning and the evening give the best result. Right? You could water them at noon, but the problem with watering at noon in the middle of summer is that then the water gets very hot from the sun. So water in the soil will be hotter than just soil. So the plant will actually get more discomfiture from being watered at noon. That's why it's not done. So according to the Veda, that would be impious, because it's against the nature of the combination of the plant and water. Because the water will get hotter than the dirt, right? Right. You have tea, you put it into a cup, right? The cup is not as hot as the tea, right? That's why you do it. If the cup was as hot as the tea, what would be the meaning, right? So earth doesn't get as hot as water. So water gets very hot. Plants need water, but they don't need hot water, right? They need cool water. So they like their heads to be hot, their feet to be cool. Right? Then they're very happy. So if you make their feet hot, not good. Right? So that's why it would be considered impious. So impious means against the nature. Does that make sense? So that's why Krishna's saying, it's against your nature to not fight. You're a Kshatriya, so you fight. Right? If he was the big Brahmin, he wouldn't say, so take part in this battle. Right? He would say, you know, walk away. What do you care? But it's his nature to fight. So therefore, do your nature, your dharma. And according to that, then you'll get, you know, your results, your artha. So therefore, people, you'll be famous. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question?
It's not enough that it's pious, then. It has to also be connected, because
if it's not connected, it's useless. See, this is also the difficulty. Because of karma, we're so used to good activity is good on its own. But that's not enough. It has to be connected. Otherwise, for the devotee, it's useless. For the karma, yes, good activity is better than bad. For the jnani, good activity is better than bad. But for the devotee, that's not what good and bad is decided by. Good and bad is decided by what's favorable to Krishna and what's not. So this is where the overlap is. Right? This overlap is the bewildering point. You can talk about it until the cows come home. And still, it's very hard for devotees to catch. Right? Does that make sense? You can see the symptomatic in how they deal with devotees depending upon their good or bad activities. And the reason they deal in the way they do is because the good activity is good and bad activity is bad on its own. Connected to Krishna or not, it doesn't matter. So they're not taking the definition of good mean it's connected to Krishna. Otherwise, then what's not good, if it's not good, then what's the first thing you have to do? You know what I'm saying? You have to connect it to Krishna. Right? The person has done something wrong, right? Like the example given before. Been involved in adultery. What's the problem? Is the adultery actually the problem? No. The problem is the lack of Krishna consciousness. So now, for correction, right, then what are you supposed to do? Increase the environment that will, adjust the environment to increase the Krishna consciousness. Right? That would be the correct thing to do if you actually understood good and bad according to Krishna consciousness. Now, if you understand good and bad according to mundane, then you're correcting the situation is not to improve Krishna consciousness, but it's retribution. It's punishment. Right? For the purpose of that injustice has been done, so therefore to the degree of injustice, then there must be a material injustice, there must be a material punishment. And that will then set the universe straight. But the universe is controlled by Krishna, as you said, he pervades everything. So it's actually bringing in balance with Krishna, that's the actual thing. You understand? So it's a completely different viewpoint. That was Swayambhuva Manu's point to Dhruva Maharaj. Is how you're dealing and killing the Yakshas, if it was a regular king, no one would say boo. It's natural. But you're a pure devotee. Why would you be seeing the way the materialist sees? Why are you looking at mundane retribution? You know, or Arjuna, why are you looking at this with mundane vision? Does that make sense? So this is where the Chinta Beta Beta Tattva overlaps, and that becomes the bewildering part. Right? So these other qualities are there so that one can appreciate it. Because if you're proud, then it's hard to appreciate. Right? The symptom of knowledge is humility. Right? If humility is there, then knowledge has been properly obtained. Right, that position, that quality. So knowledge is served through humility. So you require knowledge to understand Krishna. Right? So one must serve Krishna. And so in that service, that is done through humility. So that automatically creates the environment for perfect knowledge, which is knowledge about Krishna. You know, not the facts and figures, but the actual understanding of Krishna as a person. Does that make sense? You know, or how he is a person and in control of everything, but at the same time, he's not involved. Right? His expansions are doing. Brahman Paramatma. But at the same time, they're not involved. It's the modes of nature that are actually doing. So to be able to see all these happening at once, and there's no contradiction. So I can deal with the material energy, you know, and see how the modes work so I understand the technique. Right? I know the technique of the mechanics of dealing with this material situation. At the same time, as I understand the elements of Brahman and Paramatma, how the energies of the Lord are pervading and that's what makes it work, and Paramatma is their sanctioning and therefore it's all happening. At the same time, Krishna is a person, is there, who's beyond all this, but all this is to be connected to him. And that's the actual real point of the material world. So you have three things that seem completely contradictory, because devotees will say, okay, we have to do something practical. So where do we look? We have to look in some mundane source of knowledge, because that's the only place where practical is, because all this is just, you know, straight up front theory. But the point is that Krishna's pervaded everything. That means what makes that book that you're looking at work is Krishna. So you've connected it to Krishna, but you're connecting your illusion to Krishna. You're not connecting your knowledge to Krishna, because knowledge without Krishna is illusion. It's ignorance. Because you think it's the mechanics that make it function, when it's not. Krishna's the cause of all causes, so he's actually why it's working. Right? So that makes sense. So the secondary creation works because it's reflecting the primary creation. That's all. The primary creation pervades the secondary. That's why it works. But we only see the secondary. So we think that I did this. When actually we were only an instrument to the potency of the primary creation performing the activity. Right? But that was carried out through the modes of nature, right? So the material cause is what does it, right? And then the person is the efficient cause, does the activity. But they're still only doing the activity with the material cause that's defined by the formal cause and the original cause. You understand? So all these different elements then are contradictory. But at the same time, they're not, because they're all connected to Krishna. So would that work? So this is where difficulty comes up. Right? You know, in other words, this level of management, there's no managers on the planet that can say this. It's so far beyond anything in any management book. You know, it's like a pogo stick and a Formula One race car. You know, and that would be, you know, a euphemism. You know, maybe a slug in a Formula One race car. That might be closer. So, but it can't be seen. Why? Because one can either only see the spiritual or only see the material. One can't see the two simultaneously. That's a chinta beta beta tattva, being able to see them both simultaneously. There's nothing that Prabhupada did that he didn't see in connection to Krishna. And there was no one more expert than him. You know what I'm saying? Our biggest managers today don't even come close to anything that Prabhupada could do. I mean, nowhere close. You know what I'm saying? You did see something far out with those trained by Prabhupada. But what you see today is managerially extremely ho-hum. You know what I'm saying? Why? Because we only see the external. And the mechanics of the material nature, if you're going to deal with that, you better have some really good material karma. Otherwise, you can't do it. You know what I'm saying? You can't take, you know, a useless hippie off the street and turn him into a top-class professional. It doesn't happen. He doesn't have the karma. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't happen. Does that make sense? So, that's the thing. If you want to deal with material energy on her terms, you better be really pious. Otherwise, you'll get nowhere. But if you deal with the material mechanics and the material energy in connection with Krishna consciousness, then you're going to get somewhere. And if you can actually see how it functions, how the original and the reflection, how they function on the same mechanics, then you'll be very expert. Does that make sense? That's why it said, the pure devotee, he can never be defeated, because he sees the full mechanics. Anyone else doesn't see the full mechanics. So they can't actually understand it to the same degree. So that's why they can never be defeated. Right? The Madhyama has the knowledge, but he may be defeated because someone else is more expert in rhetoric or in logic. Right? Like we were saying, Krishna says he's vada, which is conclusion. But someone can win an argument on Vedanta. Right? He just is very expert and the power of his presentation is so strong, the other person doesn't know what to say. Like that. And that's someone who's quite expert. Then you have the normal thing, jalpa. You know, it's just kind of, you say something that's good for everybody, the politically correct position, everybody can relate to it. It's wasting time. Yes. Yes, that would be correct. You don't have to make Krishna consciousness relevant to everyone's life because actually the nature of the living entity is Krishna consciousness. But because the living entity has chosen freely to identify with the material phenomena, therefore they think there's something else. You know, it would be like, let us say you're in an insane asylum, right? Like that, just a random example, right? And you have somebody there, you know, who thinks he's Napoleon Bonaparte, okay? Now, the science of psychology doesn't change because he thinks he's Napoleon Bonaparte or Madame Curie or whatever he thinks he is. That doesn't change. And it's not that you have to make the psychological system relevant to him. Otherwise, it has no value. It has its value anyway. But the expert psychologist will then take it and present his science to Napoleon Bonaparte. So Napoleon Bonaparte sees how this applies to him. That's what you're doing. Because if you think Krishna consciousness only has relevance if it's connected to the modern, you're actually a Buddhist. It's not Vaishnava philosophy. Buddhism is, if I'm there to hear it, it happened. If I'm not there, it didn't happen. So in other words, the material phenomena is the cause of relevance. Right? And it's specifically self-centered, my existence, because they don't care if someone else, like, they're only worried about somebody in their country, in a particular class. Are they worried about, let's say, you know, those guys living in, mobile homes. What are those? They're like mobile homes, but you set them up and you live in them. Trailer parks that, you know, their kids, to find relevance in their life, are joining the army and are fighting in Iraq. Are they worried about those kids? No, they're worried about some guys down on campus or somebody in some yoga studio or something like this. And that's it. It's a particular class of, you know, middle intellectual America, and that's it. Otherwise, every other class doesn't talk like this. You know what I'm saying? The conservatives who actually run the place don't talk like this. The guy on the street doesn't talk like this, right? The farmer doesn't talk like this. The housewife doesn't talk like this. Nobody else talks like this except this little group. And they're one of the smallest groups there is. You know what I'm saying? So, but it's not that if that group gives its, you know, assent, then now Krishna consciousness has relevance. No, because they are living entities, that it's valuable that they also should be addressed. And if you know how to address properly so that you include it in their lifestyle, which these persons who say that cannot do, then they can be influential because they'll say, no, but these are the influential people in society. But you don't know what influence is, so how will you present Krishna consciousness to make it relevant that they'll be able to use their influentialness in the society? you deal with their attachments. So because they like things that are intellectual, that's why we have logic. Right? They like examples that are pleasant. We have tons of them. You know, they like a particular quality of language, a particular tone of voice. Those can be done, yes.
How about people who present themselves as such but are really very sentimental?
Then you lean more on the mental presentation. Like, in other words, you have, as we discussed in the beginning, you have the intellectual approach and you have the emotional approach. Because emotional means, anyway, emotional is going to be the basis, but it's whether you use more intelligence in it or not. Because you're going from sambandha prayojana abhideya. So, and then, well, intellectual means sambandha abhideya prayojana, right? So, basically, the difference will be is the intellectual person, who's actually more intellectual, has a strong identity. So basically, you just have to point out to them the field, right? Because they're intelligent, so they're already inspired, right? So you have to point out simply the field. So Sankarshan, you point that out. Then how that is operated, you know, is Abhideya, and then that will give you this result. So the intellectual is very straightforward. You don't have to consider, you don't have to be careful of toes, you know, while you're walking around, right, in the presentation. But now if you're dealing more emotion, then that emotion is there, so that means they're not functioning on the intellectual platform. So they're actually functioning more on prayojana. So you have to create security and identity for them. So you have to create an identity, how this is here and how it's great and we can all be together and all do all. Because the intellectual guy, you don't have to tell him that. Because he already knows, I'm here, this is here, if we interact, that'll give a result. But the other person, it's until he's inspired emotionally, then he'll use his intelligence and look at the field. You know what I'm saying? So you're going to have to create an identity. You're going to have to show how that identity will give this big result that's great for everybody and everybody's inspired. Then once that's there, then you can show the field and then how to operate it and how to get the result. So that would be the basic difference. So the point is, to us it doesn't matter because it's the same science. However you put it together, it doesn't matter. That's the perfection. Prabhupada says, sugar is sweet no matter where you start tasting it. You know, so Krishna consciousness is so perfect, it doesn't matter which side or which part you start with, you'll get to the other anyway. Because if you start with just the intellectual like that, but once they get results and become purified, then they can appreciate the higher sentiments, the finer points of the, you know, emotions and relations in Krishna consciousness. Well, the other ones, you start with that, but you're not starting with the spiritual, you're starting with material. And then when that's inspired and seeing how that material emotional experience can be engaged in Krishna's service, then they're inspired. Then they'll go, then they become purified. Then you can show them spiritual experience. You know, spiritual relationships.
So you're actually strengthening their identity and then connecting that to Krishna.
Yes. Strengthening the identity and connecting to Krishna. That's the point, is that anybody does anything that's not Krishna conscious, it's because of that lack of identity. The difficulty comes in this, you know, environment of discussion. Means, or let's say this field of discussion, is that if it's what generally would be accepted in the first world country as a pious position, if it's not connected to Krishna, nobody's worried about it. But if it's not what would be considered pious, then there's a disturbance. So only at that point then we'll say this is not Krishna conscious. You understand? Because we mentioned we're working on the logic that, okay, Krishna consciousness is good, or God is good, right? And so, therefore, good activities, you know, are stemming from God, right? So that means when something is good, it's automatically God conscious, right? But the problem is in that definition, God is a source of good. God is good. That's dealing on the spiritual platform. But for us, good doesn't mean God. Good means good activities of the world. So we've actually, our definitions have changed. So our examples are wrong. So now we take good activities of this world are automatically therefore God conscious. So if I'm being good and nice and taking care and doing all these things, that means automatically I'm the Krishna conscious person. And the person who's just, you know, out there, the manager trying to get things done and all that, he's the, you know, impersonalist and not Krishna conscious. But all it is one is efficiently getting something done, and but not being so Krishna conscious in it, but he's getting a result for Krishna. While the other one is being nice and good, and everything is nice and good, but he may not be getting any result for Krishna. But he's a nice and good person. You know, so that's why devotees before, even though they were rough and ready, they were getting results and they were advancing in Krishna consciousness because it was connected to Krishna. Right? So now, in connection to Krishna, then there's, you know, connected and then there's more ideally connected. Right? So more ideally connected means you understand the Vaishnava etiquette, but that comes from because that pleases Krishna. Does that make sense? It pleases Krishna. That's why you're doing it. Not because it's materially good. That's why I'm doing it. You know what I'm saying?
So how about in the Western world, it seems like pious and impious is kind of...
There's also that, because then something that's pious may be considered actually impious.
Yeah,
or something. In other words, like let's say... you'll see this all the time. You say, okay, husband and wife, they perform their duties, right? What is Krishna telling Arjuna? Perform your duties, right? So then we'll say, yes, this is good. You know, management, do your duties and all this. Okay, husband and wife. The husband has his duties and his wife has her duties. They perform their duties. Their relationship will go nice. And then the hand goes up and goes, no, but that's artificial. You know, you say the example of a drama, but we want real relationship. Real in the material world? Well, what are you talking about? You know, here, these two. We want a real relationship between these two rocks here. You know? Not this just drama of, you know, he's the husband rock and he's the wife rock. Like that. You know, we want real relations. It's like, you know what I'm saying? The difference if, you know, you're, you know, 5-year-old has Barbie and Ken, and then, you know, the 40-year-olds have Barbie and Ken. You know, somehow or another, their Barbie and Ken is real, but theirs is just, you know. Yeah, you know, so something like that. Yeah, but remember who makes the screenplay. Like that. It's a chick flick because generally the screenwriter was a woman. Right? And it's considered not a chick flick because a man wrote it. You know, so therefore, the guy does something totally outrageous. And then he gets a little bit, you know, careful and makes one comment. And then immediately everything's fine. Then you know the guy wrote the script.
But getting to the relationship,
because when the relationship, it's the possibility that the relationship is solid, that's where the movie ends, because nobody knows how to maintain the relationship.
And if there's a sequel, then they have to split up
together. Yeah, of course, because it's the getting together, that's the whole thing, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right.
And that's compared to the Western world's fear of conclusions.
Fear of conclusions, yeah. Because if you conclude... On the mundane platform, there's no more intellectualization. That's the difficulty. Emotionally, you want a conclusion, right? So that's why you see, you know, romantic comedies always have a good ending. Because you're dealing with emotion. You want closure in the emotion. And it's complete because the emotion is a solid platform. That emotion is Krishna. You know what I'm saying? And since that emotion is what you want to taste, so it connects to there, and therefore you can go on and on thinking. You don't have a problem in that it concluded. Right? But if you're dealing with something that would be seen as more artistic or more intellectual, they can't have a conclusion because the purpose is intellectualization. In other words, what was in the movie wasn't like it was emotional, it was like clever and very unique and different. You know, the perspective of the camera, the particular dialogue, the particular situation, all these things are very unique. You know, and so you may be taking an age-old theme, but you're presenting it in a unique way. And so you don't want a conclusion because your purpose is actually just to intellectualize. So if you have a good ending, it's kind of like you ruined it because it went from the intellectual platform to the emotional. Right? Because intellectual conclusion would be Vedanta. Because there, even though it ends mental speculation, it begins, you know, vichar, contemplation in Krishna consciousness. But if you don't know this process, then conclusion is like your worst enemy. Is this getting anywhere? So, in other words, we're dealing with these fields of contradiction that have no contradiction. Right? Therefore, the shastras can have these far out stories and be very logically presented, but at the same time be completely full with rasa. The two contradictions that modern has great difficulty working with. Those who can bring more of it together, they're more appreciated. You know, they're stories that are still appreciated after so many years, or hundreds of years, or thousands of years, because they're able to combine the two better. And something that does one or the other is very soon forgotten. Right? Because ultimately, the living entity means both intelligence and the mind. Does that make sense? You see? So these are all these different areas where, why I was giving these, are practical elements where we see the contradiction and we don't necessarily understand the Krishna conscious involvement. Does that make sense?
So could you say that a karmi has free will, but at the same time hasn't got free will?
They seemingly feel they have free, means they always have free will, but according to their previous choices, it'll put them in specific situations which will respond in generally a pretty textbook way. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, that's expected. But at the same time, that's based on the original, because those situations would be connected to Krishna. And so there would be a natural, intellectual emotional response to that situation. But it would be seen in connection with Krishna. So it'll look the same, but actually its basis is very different. You know what I'm saying? The man, you know, was looking at another, you know, at some lady. His wife gets angry and doesn't talk to him, right? Krishna was, you know, talking or looking at another gopi. Radharani gets angry. She doesn't talk to her. The mechanics are the same. You know, that's why it's so strange that one would think the modern mechanics function different than spiritual mechanics. It's one thing. There's only one energy. It's Surup Shakti. It can be applied materially or spiritually. Right? It probably gives the example. Electricity. It can heat. It can run the heater or run the refrigerator. But it's still the same mechanics. Right? So the energy of the Lord functions in the same way. It's a matter of your level of consciousness. What's the difference? Right? Does that make sense? The wife is upset because the element of then, if he's looking at this other lady, that means why isn't, what is that quality he's looking at? Why isn't he finding that in me? So then that will create an insecurity. So then that insecurity, so what is actually the strength of our relationship? You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? So that's the position there. And then what? So that means then you're frustrated in the relationship. So fear will come up. What's the next thing after fear?
Anger.
It's just the mechanics. Attachment, fear, anger. Right? But now Radharani, she's becoming angry. Why is she becoming angry? Is she insecure?
No,
it doesn't matter what Krishna does. She is Krishna's servant. That's not going to change. The point is that she's Sarup Shakti. That means she is the complete potency. And he being the complete personality of Godhead, they match. So any desire Krishna has, she can fulfill completely. Anybody else can't do that. So she's angry because Krishna won't be as satisfied with that other gopi as she would, he would be with her. That's why she's angry, because Krishna won't get the best. So the form of it, the mechanics of it, exactly the same between there and here. But the consciousness is completely different. That's why Prabhupada says gold and iron. It actually has nothing to do with each other. They're both metal, but the quality of it. So they're both rasa, but the quality of it, one's transcendental on the highest level, and the other is just on the mundane platform. That's the point. Because reflection looks the same, but you can't, what does the reflection do? Right? You can't feed the reflection or anything. You know, can't do anything with it. You know, it's winter time, it's cold, right? So you would like to wash your hair, but, you know, the cold is very uncomfortable. So what we'll do is we'll wash the hair in the reflection. Yeah, so that would work. That'd be great, no? But it doesn't work. So that means the reflection you can't do anything with. But it functions exactly the same. So when people, it goes both ways. When people say, okay, I got this book on some particular mundane knowledge, you know, some mechanics that we could use for Krishna. So Yukta Vairagya we'll use for Krishna. Okay, that's nice. So if the end result you give to Krishna, it has been Yukta Vairagya. But one has to understand is that, okay, I want to do this for Krishna. I don't know how to do it. This book tells how to do it. So I'll read this book and then do this for Krishna. Then it works. But more than that would be understanding is why does it work? Nothing can work unless it's according to God's law. So what it is in this book, by observation, by pratyaksha, then people have come up with understanding some of the workings of God's laws. You know, it's taken them a few thousand years, but, you know, they've come up with something. Right? That's why it works. So as close as it is to God's laws, that's why it works. And as close as it's not to God's laws, it doesn't work. Right? So those aspects that work is because it's close. Those aspects that don't, that's where it's not. So someone else will observe and come up with the part that's missing. But they think it's completely different theory, so they never combine them. Very rare. So then they throw out this because there's this problem. Why? Because that's more valuable to me. While the other person, this was valuable and this didn't matter to him. That's why he emphasized he was comfortable with it. But actually, it's both. That's why we say that if it's not according to the laws of nature, it's not complete. Right? So it works because it's actually based on the laws given in Veda. That's why it works. So if one sees through that, then it has even more potency. Because you know it's working because of God's laws. You have that faith. If you can understand and see mechanically how it's working according to the laws, then you'll get even more. Then the process itself will liberate you. The other one, you're engaging it, you'll become Krishna conscious, but you're not becoming liberated from the activity. Because you're not seeing that Brahman element. But you see that, then you're being liberated. At the same time, you're developing the devotional side. Because otherwise what happens, why do we say this? Because the person does this, then let's say after a few years and he's quite successful, he identifies with this body of knowledge and thinks it's the body of knowledge itself that is functioning. When it's not, it's God consciousness. That's the time when, even though it's materially successful, that's where Krishna pulls out the plug. And even though he's materially better and doing better than everybody else, nobody recognizes it anymore and it falls apart. And then he gets all frustrated and gets bitter and all that. The devotees don't understand, because materially he was right, but spiritually he was totally wrong. Because the yukta vairagya meant you were engaging it in Krishna's service, not it becomes you identifying with it. That's not yukta vairagya. You understand? That's where the problem comes. So that's why one has to apply the philosophy in applying yukta vairagya. You know, if it's very simple in the beginning, it just connects easily. You know what I'm saying? But with time, one may identify with it if one doesn't see the proper, you know, functioning of how the mechanics connect to the Lord, how the energies are working. Or if one is very pure, one may not need to do it. That's the point. Ultimately, the pure devotion, that's what you're trying to get to. So if you can skip karma yoga and jnana yoga and just go straight to pure devotion, that's the recommendation. Right? That's Krishna's first recommendation. If you can't do that, okay, then you take up the Pancharatrika or the Vedic rules and follow them. But the result should be for Krishna. You know? And if you can't do that, then be a nice guy. Be pious, open hospitals, you know, do all that stuff.
Only then you become an impersonalist, right?
Yeah, if you can't do that, then okay, then be a good, regulated, sampradayic impersonalist. At least there's some development. But that's the last option. Okay, yeah. Yeah, no, it's coming next chapter.
Maharaj, could I say that you're talking about the modern? That one of the weaknesses is that while the Vedas cut the glitter, the other one may accommodate the glitter, so that you mentioned.
Yes, in other words, your Puranic presentation will generally emphasize the element of how to engage. What the glitter actually is and how to engage the glitter in the Lord's service. Though ultimately you'll get to the point of cutting it, but it will generally go just show how the real glitter is Krishna, so therefore move into Krishna's pastimes. Right? The Upanishadic will take that there is no glitter. What you call glitter doesn't exist. Right? That actual glitter is the Lord. So there's no use in being involved in the glitter. So they just directly go to the Lord that way by cutting the other. So the Purana will engage it. So we can do both. Because the point is the glitter itself, that's Krishna. Because dead matter doesn't glitter. Right? That's the thing. It's very plain. There is no glitter to Pradhan. Right? Mahat then has some life. But that's because the Lord glance, the living entities, the false ego, all that is there. And so that potency is there, but the problem is because of the false ego, you think the glitter is the Mahat itself, not the Lord's glance. So it's the Lord's glance that makes the Mahat glitter. But because of the false ego, you think the Mahat itself is the glitter. So therefore, on that platform of Vasudeva Sattva, one's still consciousness has the Purusha Bhav. One's liberated, but one has the Purusha Bhav. And so this just becomes, you add more false ego, then instead of understanding that this mahat, or these subtle aspect, is what's creating, it actually, then you come down and think the secondary creation is the cause of the glitter. You understand?
So, putting it better, the Vedas would attribute the glitter to Krishna. It's working in the sense of putting the glitter back to Krishna.
Yeah.
While the material, we want to put the glitter more to the material manifestation.
Yeah. The more you can bring out that glitter and everything, the more it becomes attractive, because that's what's attractive. You know? It's the glitter. Like that. But the actual element, that glitter, Krishna then says in the Bhagavatam, that's him. Right? Because it's dead matter. So he's the glitter. So then understanding that, then you will connect all those activities where you value the glitter to Krishna. Right? So then it's been spiritualized. So now it becomes perfect. But Krishna is saying that still beyond that is pure devotion, in which you see me as a person, and your impetus is not the glitter in the material manifestation, and then you connect that to Krishna. But Krishna directly is your inspiration. And then you'll work with the material world to serve. But it's not because of the glitter you're working with it. So the activity doesn't change. So the materialist, the karma yogi, and the pure devotee, they're doing the same activity. Right? So this is another place where that contradiction is there. The karma yogi, jnana yogi. You're dealing with both at once. Your inspiration is ultimately is Krishna, but immediate is the material energy. Right? Gross or subtle. Like that. And then, but with time you see it's Krishna's the prominent. And then to serve him, to express that, you engage the material energy in the service. Rather than, I'm inspired by material energy, but I engage it in Krishna's service. Does that make sense?
That's where we get to Kevala Bhakti.
Yeah, that's the Kevala Bhakti. So that's the difference between what's described in the first six chapters and now what's described in the second six chapters. Right? And then we'll see in the last chapters, it gives the very fine mechanics of how the material energy works, so you can apply that, you know, either to the first or the second. Does that make sense? But the point is you have to understand the principle first. Because the last chapters are detailed. But the principle is there. Because Krishna said, already under the modes of nature, it's all going on. Principle's been established. Then he'll give the chapter on how the modes work. What is that? Is that okay? Yeah. In Bhagavad Gita 2:6, Arjuna stated that he is doubtful about the outcome of the battle. Now in verse 34, the Lord comforts his devotee by declaring, Jeta Asi, you will conquer. Krishna specifically mentions the names of Drona, Bhishma, and Karna, who are the most feared Kaurava soldiers. The Lord also adds the name of Jayadratha, who, although not so powerful, received a boon by Shiva to be able to stop the Pandavas once. Krishna thus assures Arjuna that his concern about Jayadratha is unnecessary. Right? So now this is the emotional aspect. He's bringing in that thing. He's established the others, the intellectual. Now, once that's accepted, then you can bring in the emotional. Like that. So you have to find that balance between what's going to work. But now, he's given it in connection with, he started with work. Why? He's a Kshatriya. If it doesn't practically get done, it's not there. But at the same time, Kshatriyas are intellectuals. So, in other words, it has to be practical intellectualism. So now that you've shown the practical, now you can show the intellectual aspect of it. You know what I'm saying? The Brahman will start with the intellectual, then go down to the practical. The Kshatriya will start with the practical, go back to the intellectual. But they both will function on these two together. Does that make sense? Okay. That wasn't a question. You know, it's just like, you know, when you have in the auctions, you know, guys that always go to do the auction, they each have their specific little thing. You know, the one guy his hat, the other guy clicks his false teeth, or, you know, different things like that. So here's like questions. Everybody has their own way of kind of like, you know, one would kind of like to go up to here, and then they go to here. And then, you know, so each one has their own. So it's just how you start go like this. So is that going to turn into?
They must get expert in
deciphering. Kind of. Okay, and then Jayadratha, because he's going to be a problem here because of that boon, but it's only going to happen once, but then he'll also be mentioned because this will turn into a whole big pastime, right? So that'll be a very prominent element. But now also Drona, Bhishma, Karna he'll be worried about in the fighting. Bhishma, Drona as far as fighting, but that wasn't his big anxiety. His big anxiety was is killing them. But Krishna's already said they're already dead. So you don't have to worry about that. You know, it's like you either kill them or you're going to die anyway. So you get the credit. Because you pointed out, Bhishma is, remember, he is the son of Ganga Devi. He has been trained by Brihaspati and by Ushanas, right? Sukracharya, and so many others. Parasaram, this one, that one. He's been learned from them. So there's no human that can defeat him like that. He even defeated Parasaram, but because it would look bad, you know. Therefore, it was suggested that he, you know, surrender. And so then he did. So, but here, if Arjuna defeats him, then it'll be someone who no one could defeat, he does. Right? That's right. You know, so many are killed, but like, let's say, the Nivatakavachas. Why is that such a special thing? That Arjuna defeated them. Because the demigods couldn't. They had tried and they couldn't, but Arjuna defeated them. Right? So these things are there. Okay. So you always have to find a balance. If it's purely intellectual, it's not good enough. It has to bring around and bring out that element of relationship. And if it's just a relationship without actual understanding of the function of it and the mechanics of it, that's also not good enough. Because sentiment's not enough to make a relationship work. Right? If it was, then everybody on the planet would be perfect. Right? Because the guy got married. He didn't know, you know, anything about, you know, taking care of a woman. He likes women, but he doesn't know how to take care of them. But because he got married, he's a world expert on women. Right? And neither of them had any idea about kids, but because they had one, now they're the world experts on kids. Right? So you wouldn't have any problems anywhere if that was the actual fact. Right? So that means knowledge is necessary. Right? So you have to balance the two. But the knowledge, it has to be applied in the personal environment, right? To relationships. So if that's not there, what's the use? If it doesn't end up in practical application, it's of no use. Same time, practical application can't function without knowledge. So the chit potency is action and knowledge. So if you have one or the other, only knowledge, that's jnana. Only action, that's karma. When the two are combined, that's the Buddha yoga. Right? That's action in Krishna consciousness. Right? So it said action in Krishna consciousness. So we could say, well, the jnana aspect's left out. No, because Krishna consciousness means you have that knowledge of Krishna. And so therefore that consciousness of Krishna. Right? And so it's applied. You have you're conscious of Krishna, you have the knowledge of Krishna, you have the knowledge of the activity, you're conscious of the activity, you're performing the activity, the result is for Krishna. Right? You're remembering Krishna and performing the activity, so then that's where it becomes perfect. Okay. Yes?
If somebody doesn't feel interested about the knowledge of how a relationship will function, could that be because their emotional needs have not been met and that's the focus? So they don't feel like they want to understand how the mechanics of the relationship?
Possibly, but you'd have to see is how are their relationships. You know what I'm saying? Do their relationships go fine? So it could also be they grew up in an environment that it all worked very nicely, so they never thought about it. But by the influence of, what do you call it? The word Prabhupada uses. The arrogance of youth. Then, you know, they think everything's going perfect anyway because it works for them. They grew up in an environment like that. It's just normal. So you might have that aspect. But the point is somehow or another relationships have the element of, at some point, addressing the arrogance. Right? Does that make sense?
I don't understand the arrogance.
Arrogance of youth?
Yeah.
Youth starts at 16 and goes to 30. Okay. Be a little more blunt. In youth, one's has energy and enthusiasm, so one may not be so conscious of one's surroundings. And it seems to work for them. right? So as long as one's not applying it seriously into a masculine, feminine element or in something that you really want to be maturely successful at, right? In either success mechanically or success emotionally, then things will go fine, you know? But as soon as one wants actually to get some serious results, either observably or experientially, then that's where the lack of knowledge will start to weigh on one. You know what I'm saying? You know, like that. So that would be one aspect. The other aspect could be is that they're aware of it, but they don't want to know about it because to them relationships have been a problem, so therefore knowing about relationships would also be a problem. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? You know, so that it could happen either way. But the point is that's why then one is trained in these things generally from when one is younger before that kind of arrogance comes up. So one's aware of it and knows how relationships function before one comes to the point that one starts to become aware. Does that make sense? Yeah. Then it works. Then it becomes very natural. Like that. In other words, it won't take, simply one has to practically apply and just see how it gets done. Rather than one has to practice it and actually develop the understanding of it and the faith in it. So it just saves a few years. Like that. In other words, yeah, one won't be 60 and trying to figure it out. Is that okay? Yes.
Maharaj, concerning acting as Krishna citizen, there is a difference in sometimes emphasizing the practical own endeavor or depending on Krishna's mercy and
the praying. No, but what are you depending on the mercy for? What exactly are you depending on the mercy for? Get some service done. So what does the term done indicate? A result. So in other words, the result is up to Krishna. So whether you know what you're doing or don't know what you're doing, still the result's up to Krishna. That's the formula, right? If you have focus, you have endeavor, and dependence upon the Supreme for the result, that is perfect action. You understand? Then those can be broken down. But those are the three main things. You know what I'm saying? So the focus means you know the work, you know what you're supposed to do, you know what results you can get, you know what all the different aspects within the field that you're working with can do, and your position in it, you know, and what you're supposed to do. And so then you can, therefore, with that focus, make the endeavor. You know what I'm saying? But when the endeavor is going on, focus is still remains. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah. So the result, because your focus, yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that's the point. So there's no contradiction between understanding the philosophy and being very expert in material skills. In fact, the two go together. Right? It's only because of our concept of being influenced by either karma or jnana that we don't see how the two work together. Like the jnanis can't understand why anyone would work. And the karmis can't understand why someone would sit around and not work and philosophize. You understand?
Does it have something to do with karma or kshatriya nature?
No, because the Vaishya-shudras also. You know, the point is Bhaktivinoda Thakura mentions that material consciousness is of two kinds, right? That's why you have it's dualistic, right? Karma or jnana. So all philosophies, all religions, they all fit into karma or jnana or any combination, right? While in the spiritual world, there's a non-dual perception. Right? That Krishna is supreme, everyone's his servant. There's no living entity in the spiritual realm that thinks differently than that. Right? But in the material world, then nobody thinks like that, and they think of everything according to the duality of karma and jnana. Right? So one's good, the other's not good. Does that make sense? So all philosophies come from these two. So that's why then it's hard to see. We're not practiced at seeing the two together. So that's where the contradiction is. Because Buddha Yoga means you're doing all the activities of karma with the detachment that would be there in jnana. That's contradictory, because the karma works because of his attachment to the result. And at the same time, you have the knowledge of the jnani, but you're performing the activity of the karma. So these are all contradictory. We're not used to this. So that's why this aspect of the philosophy, this is the part that's difficult to understand. You know what I'm saying?
Maharaj, could I say that the difficulty in leaving the result to Krishna, that asks me to surrender?
Yes. You have to surrender, because the result's then for someone else. Both, you have to surrender that I'm the doer, but also that I'm the enjoyer. So that deals with both aspects, you know. Because if someone else is actually causing the result, I'm not the doer. And if therefore they're causing the result, the result's theirs. So I'm not the enjoyer. So, you know, not good for polluted consciousness. Right? You know. Not. Would not be auspicious for it.
Okay.
You understand? So that's why so much emphasis is put on, you know, in these things, you can do it, or being result-oriented or goal-oriented. These are the prominent elements that are there. Because you want it can happen, you know, because you're the doer, you know, you make it happen, you know, and, you know, you have a goal, so therefore, you know, work towards that. You see that. Both are correct, but not from the materialistic point of view. You can do it because the point is you're an instrument. So the soul's nature is that of a servant. So that means automatically instrument. Servant means instrument. So Krishna's potencies are what carry things out, so you can be an instrument in this. Even he's telling Arjuna, doesn't say, you go out and do this. He says, you be an instrument. For being an instrument, you'll be given the glory. Because Krishna doesn't need the glory. He is glory itself. So you don't need opulence, because he is that opulence. Like, for him, it's the interaction. You know what I'm saying? So that's the... Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So then verses 35 to 46. Okay. Arjuna is growing even more fearful. Srila Prabhupada states that, quote, Arjuna became bewildered in wonder. Thus he began to offer his respectful obeisances to Krishna again and again. And with faltering voice he began to pray, not as a friend, but as a devotee in wonder. So, let's say 35. Sanjaya said to Dhritarashtra, O king, after hearing these words from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the trembling Arjuna offered obeisances with folded hands again and again. He fearfully spoke to Lord Krishna in a faltering voice as follows. Arjuna said, O master of the senses, the world becomes joyful upon hearing your name, and thus everyone becomes attached to you. Although the perfected beings offer you their respectful homage, the demons are afraid and they flee here and there. All this is rightly done. O Great One, greater than Brahma, you are the original creator. Why then should they not offer their respectful obeisances unto you? O Limitless One, God of gods, refuge of the universe, you are the invincible source, the cause of all causes, transcendental to this material manifestation. You are the original personality of Godhead, the oldest, the ultimate sanctuary of this manifested cosmic world. You are the knower of everything, and you are all that is knowable. You are the supreme refuge above the material modes. O limitless form, this whole cosmic manifestation is pervaded by you. You are air, you are the supreme controller, you are fire, you are water, and you are the moon. You are Brahma, the first living creature, you are the great grandfather. I therefore offer my respectful obeisances unto you 1,000 times, and again and yet again. Obeisances to you from the front, from behind, and from all sides. O unbounded power, you are the master of limitless might. You are all-pervading, and thus you are everything. Thinking of you as my friend, I have rashly addressed you. O Krishna, O Yadava, O my friend, not knowing your glories. Please forgive whatever I might have done in madness or in love. I have dishonored you many times, jesting as we were relaxed, lay on the same bed, or sat or ate together, sometimes alone and sometimes in front of many friends. O infallible one, please excuse me for all those offenses. You are the father of this complete cosmic manifestation, of the moving and the non-moving. You are its worshipable chief, the supreme spiritual master. No one is equal to you, nor can anyone be one with you. How then could there be anyone greater than you within the three worlds, O Lord of immeasurable power? You are the supreme Lord, to be worshipped by every living being. Thus I fall down to offer you my respectful obeisances and to ask your mercy. As a father tolerates the impudence of a son, a friend the impudence of a friend, or a wife the familiarity of her partner, please tolerate the wrongs I may have done you. After seeing this universal form, which I have never seen before, I am gladdened, but at the same time my mind is disturbed with fear. Therefore, please bestow your grace upon me and reveal again your form as the personality of Godhead, O Lord of Lords, O abode of the universe. Right, so let's say the form, the personality of Godhead, because this is just his unlimited qualities and power, the universal form, though it's all personally manifest. But at the same time, it's not him as a person. He's beyond. O universal form, O thousand-armed Lord, I wish to see you in your four-armed form, with helmeted head and with club, wheel, conch, and lotus flower in your hands. I long to see you in that form. Arjuna praises the Lord to whom everyone except the demons are attracted. Srila Valadeva Vidyabhushan writes in his commentary to verse 36. Seeing simultaneously in one place the very attractive and very fierce forms of the Supreme Lord, Arjuna understood those two forms were objects of vision corresponding to people who are favorable to or against the Lord. Arjuna says, rightly, O Hrishikesh, you are the one who inspires the senses towards or against you. The nature of the senses is to be either attracted or to be repulsed by an object. Rightly, the universe, headed by the devatas, Gandharvas, Siddhas, and Vidyadharas, inclined favorably to you, are pleased with and attracted to this glorious form, which destroys the wicked. It is also fitting that those of wicked nature, those opposed to you, such as Rakshasas, Asuras, and Danavas, are afraid of this form praised by the devatas, and flee in all directions. This takes place because you show an appropriate form according to the nature of the living entity. Right, so here then we see again is being brought out in the universal form that the reason of something being good or not, or what's right and wrong, is based on its connection to the Lord. That's all. So those who are connected to the Lord, then there's all these nice, wondrous elements. Those who are not connected to the Lord, then there's all these elements that are not nice. So ultimately, everything that's going on that's nice is because of its inclination towards the Lord. And anything that's not going nice in the world is because of its inclination against the Lord. Right? Does that make sense? Still, one may say, okay, then if everybody's doing everything perfectly and always directing everything towards the Lord, then everything would be perfect. Means materially. Means it would be the nicest that can be in the material world. But even if everything's very nice, still there's the element of death. Right? So that does not work with the living entity. Right? Does that make sense? So that's the point. It just doesn't work for the living entity. So the temporary element just doesn't, because sat means eternity. Right? And because your happiness is connected to that eternity, therefore the happiness is eternal. So, but if your happiness is connected to the temporary, that means your happiness is going to be temporary. Right? Endeavor is the same. Right? We've already established that whether it's spiritual or material, the mechanics of endeavor are the same. But the difference is the eternal aspect and the and the element of happiness. And whether we're an instrument in that endeavor and in that happiness, or whether we're trying to be, you know, the cause of endeavor and the enjoyer of happiness.
Maharaj, when we opt to the spiritual option and something doesn't work out nice,
mm-hmm.
is that our perspective which makes it nice? Even though it material, it would not be nice, but if you have the right perspective, it can be nice.
Yes. Means that aspect you can do to bring it nice, but it's not a matter of it's an emotional, you know, a sentimental element that it's nice. It's not that it's, but it's a point of one gets beyond it. Let us say, one is cooking something. Okay, so you go to get something, and so you get the package, but then, you know, you can't open it. So then you have to go and look and get the scissors. Then you can open it, right? And then having opened it, then, you know, then you have to sift it. You can't just put it in your bowl and add some water and mix it up. So you have to sift it. So there's all these obstacles that are there. So if you're just seeing cooking and that, these are just all things that come in the cooking. So the obstacle isn't actually a problem. Right, because you're seeing that bigger picture. Right? But someone who doesn't necessarily see the bigger picture, someone who's just come to help with something, and you say, oh hey, open this and do that, to them that can be so much big trouble because they can't see the whole process and where that fits in and the end results and all those different things. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? It's not that you're in the kitchen and going, wow, this is so great, it's Krishna's mercy, I can't find the scissors, oh isn't this wonderful? No, it's just a matter of, you know, it's just the way it is. So you look, because you can't find them, it doesn't mean you stop serving. So you keep, right. So there's a pastness. Somehow or another, Krishna wants to create these obstacles. You know, there's something to be gained there.
I mean, like Kunti, you know, she had obstacles.
Yes, because at those times in obstacles, you generally remember, you're guaranteed you'll remember. Right? Does that make sense? So that's why it means you may say in a moment, remember the good times, you know, like that. That's there, but that's only because you're in bad times. You'll say that. So you'll say, remember the good times so you don't think about the person badly. But the bad times make you remember then the Lord. Right? That's why the demigods, the Asura means one who remembers the Lord when things are bad. Right? So then in that way you could take it that, you know, on the positive side that we mentioned in the class before, is that then the Judaic concept of always remembering all the bad difficulties that have happened in the past that everyone's done to you, and that reminds you of your identity as, you know, a Jew, to, you know, in this way then remember God, you might attribute to it some quality of the demigods. Like that. Right? If you look at it from that perspective. Because when things go rough, then they remember their heritage, so then they're more God conscious. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. But the point is then there's the element of revenge and everything like that. So, but with Kunti, it's just that when there's difficulties, then they would be more thinking of Krishna. And then there's also the element, when there's difficulty, then you always think of that person. Right? If everybody in the family, everything's going nice, the person having the problem, the attention goes to them. Right? And then when everything's nice, then the attention will go to someone else. Right? So therefore, the Pandavas are dear. When they have difficulty, then the Krishna will be, you know, thinking of them.
Reciprocation element.
Yeah, that's the whole point that's being given here by Baladev. It's reciprocal. As the person is appreciating, that's where it's reciprocated. Because the demigods appreciate the wonder of God. That's the element that they're given. Right? So they have their wonderful chariots and their powers and their offices and all these things because they appreciate that in God. Right? Well, the demons don't appreciate it in God. They're always trying to take it away and say it's theirs, so therefore God's always taking it away from them. So it's reciprocal. Right? So that's the whole point. Everything's always reciprocal. The Lord deals with the living entity how he surrenders. The opportunity is given to surrender, so depending upon how he deals in that environment, then that's what you do. You know what I'm saying? Like that. So it's the environment's created. So therefore, it's not, that's why we say it's not the relation, it's in support of the relationship, but it's not actually the dynamic aspect of the relationship creating the environment in which a relationship will happen. You know what I'm saying?
No,
means, as we say, you know, a practical example, the husband creates the environment in which the family will function, right? So he has his way of making his money, you know, he has his particular house, the other facilities of the house, the social status that comes along with that, you know, the kind of education he provides for his kids, the medical, the everything that he does for them, taking them on vacations. All that, but that's the environment of the relationship. It's not actually the dynamic relationship. You could say this is the static aspect because then in that house they could interact, but it's the interaction that's actually the relationship. You understand? So Krishna provides everything. He provides the Vedas, he provides the parampara, he provides all that. You have to take it up. Depending now we're saying in the house, now let's say you come in and think you're going to sit in the study. You know, but the wife says, no, let's sit in the living room. So then you reciprocate with that. You don't say, no, I want to sit in the study. That wouldn't be masculine. Right? The masculine is the feminine wants to sit in the living room. You sit there. You can say, well, where's my, you know, masculinity? Your masculinity, you provided the living room. You understand? You have to know what it is. So you reciprocate with what's there. You set the definition. He brings in so much money, so therefore, when they are choosing, you know, what hotels they'll go to, what restaurants they'll go to, it will be within their budget. Right? You know, it's like, you know, they generally stay in a 3-star hotel, then the wife's not going to say, wow, wouldn't it be nice to spend a week, you know, in, you know, the Burj Al Arab, you know, like that? You know, it's like that. You know, it's like, you know, hey, but we, you know, we have 6 kids. Yeah, well, they have, you know, 4 bedroom, up, hotel rooms, right? You know, so she's not going to say that. Why? Because that's not the environment he's provided. Right? So within that environment, then they'll be chosen. What about this one? Yeah, it was nice, but, you know, the food wasn't so good. But this one was okay like that. You know, like that. So they'll stay within the environment created by the man. Right? Does that make sense? But, so Krishna provides the environment of opportunity that the living entity can surrender. So those who surrender, then they see the wonderment and everything like the demigods, and it's all nice, nice. Right? And for the demons who don't surrender, then therefore things just don't quite go right for them.
Right? So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is giving 5-star hotels, tokens.
Well, in this example, it was 7-star.
Oh, 7-star. So,
yeah. Yeah, like that. But you have to take it. You know what I'm saying? Even if you get the token, But you still have to take it and go there and do it. It means, in other words, you have to go through an endeavor to apply it. You can't just sit right here and say, okay, where is it? You know? Wow, look at the gold leaf rocks. You know, like that, you know. No, it's not happening. You have to go there. Does that make sense? So, and here.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivrinda ki, Jainatai Gaurapani.